for the appellant. Would you open your argument, please?
Yes, good morning, your honors. May it please the court, John Brown on behalf of the appellant, the City of Plantation Police Officers Pension Fund. We respectfully submit that the district court's decision dismissing the securities fraud case should be reversed. The district court failed to give proper consideration to the totality of the allegations in this complaint. In an opinion containing almost zero analysis, the district court, one, adopted wholesale, without discussion, the arguments in defendant's brief, and two, stated that the complaint was lacking allegations of falsity, scienter, and loss causation. In reality, the 119-page complaint had detailed allegations on each of these elements. And let me talk about falsity first, if it pleases the court. This case centers around Meredith's $2.8 billion 2018 acquisition of Time Incorporated. This was the most important acquisition in Meredith's history, and defendants told the market that it would deliver enormous benefits to the company. The market was extremely focused on the integration of Time's business with Meredith's business, and analysts asked repeated questions about it during the class period, and defendants spoke about it on literally every public statement they made during the class period.
Mr. Brown, would you highlight for us and cite to us specifically the allegations in the complaint that you think were the strongest points for false statements and what the error was in the court in discounting those?
Yes, Your Honor, I will. So the primary false statements that we're talking about are false statements where the defendants told the market that the integration between Time and Meredith was meeting expectations. Time was matching the historical levels of Meredith. That's in paragraphs 204 and 229 of the complaint and other places as well. And that the company would achieve $550 million in analyzed cost savings and $1 billion in EBITDA, additional EBITDA in fiscal year 2020. In particular, Your Honors, in February of 2019, the defendants told the market that, quote, we have fully integrated our HR, finance, legal, and IT functions. They also told the company they told the market 1 month later that integration work is yielding greater synergies than we first expected. These statements are the false statements that we're talking about. The revelation of these...
Why aren't the vast majority of those just corporate puffery and optimistic rhetoric?
Well, that's defendant's arguments, Your Honor. And it's true that some of these statements and many of these statements were forward-looking, but they weren't puffery. What they were about was the current, most important, actually historic acquisition by Meredith of Time, the most important thing that this company had ever done. And they were the statements that we allege in the complaint, as we contend, Your Honor, contain both current statements of present fact and some forward-looking statements regarding what they hope to achieve or expected to achieve from the Meredith versus Time acquisition. We allege in the complaint that at the time they made these statements, both the current representations of historical fact were not supported and were, in fact, completely false on the ground. And the forward-looking statements that they made were necessarily unattainable at the time that they made them. I don't think necessarily unattainable is actually the standard in the elements. The standard in the Eighth Circuit that should apply. We can talk about the Cerner case when Your Honors want to or if you want to. But even if it is the standard that should apply, these statements were necessarily unattainable, and here's why. The merger between Time and Meredith, the integration between those two companies, it was necessary to go smoothly and be successful for them to attain the financial metrics that they had said to the market that they would attain. So when, Your Honor, and let me just, I think it's really important in this case to focus on the statements that the defendants actually said, and some of the very specific statements. So in May of 2019, 2 months after they come out and say that they were fully integrated and they were achieving greater synergies than they first accepted, things that analysts loved, obviously, they come out and say, well, it will take longer than we originally anticipated to achieve the remainder of the synergies. Defendants contend before this court, and they contended before the district court, that this somehow exonerates them from securities fraud. But it doesn't, because at the same time, they reaffirm that they, quote, remain confident they would achieve cost synergies of $550 million by the end of fiscal 2020, and they do not modify any of their prior statements saying that they expect EBITDA improvement of $1 billion in fiscal 2020. In fact, 1 month after the statement that I assume, because it's difficult to tell from the district court's opinion what the district court was relying upon, but I assume the district court was referring to the May statement as saying that the defendants disclosed all of their difficulties. 1 month after that statement, Defendant Hardy, the CEO, comes out and he says, we've made excellent progress on synergy achievement and debt reduction. The market was deceived, it was misled, and it did not learn the truth until September 5th, 2019, when they literally stunned the market by saying that they had $94 million in restructuring and impairment charges.
Counsel, let me ask you about the fully integrated statement. You mentioned that as one of your strongest statements. I think you mentioned it in response to Judge Grunder's question. I think it's probably your strongest statement as well, that it fully integrated the HR finance functions. But what I'm wondering about is, as I recall, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that was made by Mr. Hardy. And Mr. Hardy was not on the committee dealing with the integration. And so I think that might be why the district court relied on Scienter, because there's at least a pretty good argument that Mr. Hardy didn't know that the statement would have been false or didn't intend that the statement would be false. What's your response to that, or your best response to that?
Yeah, my best response to that, Your Honor, is that this was the primary focus of the company at the time. And Mr. Hardy was the CEO, and he had his major deputy, the CFO. Anyone who's ever been a part of a public company knows the CEO and the CFO operate in tandem, basically, and they know things together. And the CFO was on the integration committee. And you know why he was? It was the most important thing that was dominating this company's attention at the time. So I would say, although it is correct, Your Honor, obviously, that we could not find at this point in time a former employee who would say to us that these reports that were flagged red and indicated that the integration was completely behind schedule and absolutely unattainable. We don't have a CEO who directly links that to Mr. Hardy. What we do have, though, is a former employee who directly links that to Defendant Cyrenac, who admittedly, by defendants, sat on the integration steering committee, admittedly, I think, attended these meetings, and obviously would have known about this information. So to slice and dice it and say, well, Mr. Hardy, the CEO, maybe he made a little false statement. Well, the guy who was sitting next to him, the CFO, who was responsible for the most important project in this company's history, and the project that Defendant Hardy was talking about, actually knew contrary information. I respectfully submit the complaint has pled sufficient detail to allow that claim to proceed.
Don't we have to infer, to follow up on that, that the CFO, sort of that the CFO and the CEO had a close relationship and sort of presume or assume that at some point the CFO, based on what was going on in the committee, would have informed the CEO? And can we make that inference at this stage?
Okay, so Your Honor, no, you don't have to, and yes, you can, are my answers to that question. So no, you don't have to, because we allege that the CFO knew the information, okay? And the CFO also made false statements. And it's just an artifice. It's an absolute artifice, not compelled by Janus, which I'm sure Your Honors know. It's not compelled by any decision that the highest levels of the company can make misrepresentations, and we get to parse, well, that guy made it, but maybe that guy didn't know, at the pleading stage. And that's a key point here, at the pleading stage. Perhaps, maybe, when it's at trial, I will say, because I'm a plaintiff's lawyer, but we won't talk about summary judgment, but perhaps at trial, that's correct. Maybe not. We'll see what the jury says. But at the pleading stage, when literally the number two person at the company and the number three and the number four, and we allege the number one, Hardy, clearly knew about this information. It was critical. It was the stuff that analysts asked about all the time. So that's my answer to you. No, you don't have to make that inference. Two, I think you can make that inference because Defendant Cernak didn't put himself on the steering committee. He was placed there by the management of this company, and he was placed there because he was trusted by them to do, again, I'm sorry to keep repeating it, but it's true, the most important acquisition in the history of this company. The only thing, really, that analysts, shareholders, and market commentators talked about with respect to Meredith during this class period. So I hope that answers your question, Your Honor, but I'm happy to follow up.
Mr. Brown, what does it mean to be fully integrated, and is that term subject to multiple interpretations?
It might be in certain instances, Your Honor, but when you say we fully integrated, so okay, of course, if you just said fully integrated, I understand Your Honor's point that the brief sometimes just kind of quote that point, but the actual statement was we fully integrated our HR, finance, legal, and IT functions. That absolutely was not true. And the complaint definitely alleges that it was.
But what does it mean? I mean, does it mean they're housed in the same facility? Does it mean they talk to each other? Does it mean we've cut people from, you know, various, from one company to the next? What does that term mean?
Well, I don't, what it means, Your Honor, and what investors understood it to mean was that the integration that they had been monitoring for 18 months had gone successfully. And the EBITDA and the cost savings and numbers, which investors cared about, were going to be achieved. Because you have to understand, these things were completely integrated, right? They were interdependent, right? The integration of the two companies was necessarily part of the ability of the company to attain the EBITDA and cost savings numbers that they had put out there to the market. So I absolutely take Your Honor's point that it could mean different things in different contexts, but they didn't just say fully integrated and stop. They said we fully integrated our HR, finance, and IT functions. It wasn't true. It's not true. And the complaint clearly alleges it's not true. At a minimum, the IT and HR functions were not integrated. Why that mattered to investors when they made that statement, and I would respectfully submit the reason that they made that statement, was because they knew it would matter to investors. Because investors knew from the entire context of everything these defendants said during the class period that that integration was necessary to attain the numbers that they had put forth in the market, which they, as we know, and I know Your Honor knows because you've read the papers, but they didn't attain. They completely didn't attain. And they were saying as soon as June of 2019 that they were going to attain them. And in September, they didn't. And I would just like to say one last point, although you know, Judge Gordon, if that didn't answer your question, I'm happy to keep going. But if it did, I would like to follow up and make one more point.
Well, I guess I'm still just having a hard time understanding what the idea of fully integrated means. In other words, how would you prove that down the road? That the two HR departments didn't talk to each other, or they hadn't terminated a certain number of employees to reach the EBITDA predictions? I think in my mind, your forward-looking statements are subject to the puffery issue. Your best one, in my mind, is the one you focused on and Judge Strauss focused on, this fully integrated. But I'm just having a hard time understanding exactly what that means in this context and how you would prove that that was in fact false.
Yeah, Your Honor, it's an excellent question, obviously, but I would say that, again, they didn't stop it fully integrated. They said that fully integrated their HR, finance, legal, and IT functions. So the way that we would prove that that was not correct is that they had not done that. The complaint contains copious allegations that none of those processes were integrated. In fact, you don't even have to take my word for it. On May 10th, 2019, they come out and kind of admit it. I think they claimed before the district court they did admit it. I think the district court got that wrong, and I think they didn't fully admit it, but they kind of admit it. They say, well, look, the synergies that we expected to achieve are going to take a little bit longer than we expected. And they're going to parse that statement on rebuttal and say, we didn't mean this, and we didn't mean that, and we didn't mean this. But the reality is, the market did not know the reality of the disastrous state of affairs on the integration, which, again, was necessary for them to attain the numbers until September 2019. And we know that the market didn't know that because it had a 23% stock drop when the poof, $400 million of EBITDA disappeared. I'm quoting an analyst. I'm not trying to be, you know, rhetorical here. An analyst said, poof, $400 million.
Mr. Brown, I don't want to take up all your time, but it just sort of reminds me of my days getting an MBA when all you had were these buzzwords like synergy and fully integrated, and I never understood what they meant back then. But I'm still sure I don't understand what they mean.
And I do take your point, Your Honor, and I think if those statements were made in a vacuum without any connection to the most important transaction in the company's history, if you just said, we treat our customers well, okay, I wouldn't be here saying that's not buffering, okay? I wouldn't be. But if you say we fully integrated our HR, IT, finance, and legal functions in the context of analysts always asking about that question, and in the context of the market understanding that this integration was necessary to attain the financial benefits that have been promised, which they expected to happen because of the defendant's statements, it was false. And I think if you even look, and maybe I'll save this for rebuttal because I understand I'm running out of time, but I think if you even look at the way that the defendants described why they made that EBITDA miss, the defendants themselves ascribed it to two things, which absolutely should sustain our complaint. And I'm going to hit one, and then if I have time, I'll rebuttal at the other, but I want to answer your question. So the defendant Hardy in 2019 said that the missing $400 million in EBITDA was in part two things. The second thing was the number of low-margin magazine subscriptions we encountered in the Legacy Times brand. It is impossible, literally impossible, to read this complaint and say they did not know that throughout the entire class period. Maybe they didn't. I don't know. It'll be reckless if they didn't. But we allege that this was discovered in due diligence. That's paragraph 121 of our complaint. It was magazine 101 to know the low-margin magazine subscriptions, that they got this information on a daily, weekly, and monthly basis, paragraph 106 of the complaint, and that this information was actually available to plaintiffs after the class period when we looked at it by getting data from the Alliance for Audit and Media, paragraph 113, and the defendants admitted it. They admitted.
So I want to ask you, I'm going to go back to the fully integrated statement one more time. I'm going to follow up on Judge Grutter's question. Now, when I read the fully integrated statement, I read it as we're going to have one department serving both companies or both firms in each of these departments, HR, finance, etc. Perhaps the same software. So one was running an older software, one was running a newer software. We'd integrate the software so that it'd be more efficient, etc. Is that? But as I listen to you now, I'm starting to doubt my own understanding of fully integrated. And that's perhaps that's because of what's going on in this case. But is that your understanding of fully integrated, or am I missing the boat too?
I don't think you're missing the boat, Your Honor. I think it's perhaps capable of interpretation, but the way that it was interpreted in the context of the statements during the class period, that this integration was sort of like the necessary precondition or first step to achieving the numbers that they had put out to the market. And as we allege in the complaint internally, they had targeted February as their fully integrated date. They came out and announced that they were fully integrated in February, and then came out in May and kind of admitted they weren't. And the complaint, whether they admitted it or not, because I know that people can parse these words, because when people speak publicly, I think they did admit it in May, but the complaint clearly alleges that they were not fully integrated until August at the minimum. And there's a direct link, there really is. I mean, as much as we can possibly allege at this point in time without discovery, there is a link between that failure to integrate and the shocking, stunning, largest stock drop in this company's history since 1986, when they took down the, and again, I'm not being rhetorical, I'm just quoting an analyst, poof, $400 million disappeared. I'm going to answer your question, but if not, Your Honors, I'm going to reserve like 45 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Ms. Lightdale?
Good morning, and may it please the court. Sarah Lightdale for Meredith Corporation, Stephen Lacey, Thomas Hardy, Joseph Saranek, and Jonathan Werther. Your Honors, I want to directly answer the question that I heard asked several times. What does fully integrated mean? Words matter. and the words that Mr. Hardy used on February 11, 2019 have commonly understood meanings. Merriam-Webster defines integrated as marked by the unified control of all aspects. The complaint does not and could not allege any facts to show that Meredith and Times, HR, finance, legal, and IT business functions were not in fact under unified control as of the date of that statement, February 2019. Now, I want to note that there is circuit level authority finding that very similar statements are puffing and are not rendered false by the recounting of issues encountered during corporate integrations, because, Your Honors, all corporate integrations involve issues. And for that authority, I would direct the courts to the 10th Circuit's Novell case, which we've cited in our briefing. The statement there was substantial success in integrating our sales forces, and that was found not to be actionable. And also not circuit level, but a very, very similar fact pattern was considered by the Northern District of California in the Kane v. Madge case mentioned.
Counsel, I want to ask you about the fully integrated, and before you move off that point, you define it similarly to how I define it, which is unifying the systems, putting them together. But then we have this, and this my understanding of this was pleading. We have an anonymous employee who says that the finance department was still running on two separate platforms or two separate systems. So if you define it the way you define it, that seems that testimony that what the anonymous employee is purportedly going to say seems to run directly counter to a fully integrating the finance department.
Certainly, Your Honor, I'm glad you gave me an opportunity to address that. This court warned in MEMC and the Seventh Circuit warned in Higginbottom that confidential witness or anonymous former employee allegations must be given a heavy discount. So it is required under the Reform Act to look at that allegation carefully. The theory of falsity, the software allegation, is a rumor. It is not well pled. It's a rumor that the employee, FE8, as is quoted in the complaint, is recounting having heard from somebody, we don't know who, after he left the company. We don't know who he heard it from. We don't know when he heard it. We don't know how they would know. And under Shoemaker and MetaWave and many of the other cases that we have cited in our briefing where courts take careful looks at the confidential witness allegations precisely because of the ability to manipulate and fuzzy them up, those cases tell us that this allegation is inadequate. And further, Your Honor, let's set that aside. Let's set aside Higginbottom and MEMC and the fact that the employee wasn't there at the time that he purports to be talking, that Mr. Hardy made this statement, that he purports to be saying he knows Mr. Hardy was lying. Let's assume that the finance department was running two back office enterprise resource planning software programs at this point in time. As Mr. Brown has acknowledged, there is no pleading that anybody told Mr. Hardy that. What I hear Mr. Brown sub silentio invoking is the core operations doctrine, which is a notion that something can be so important that everybody at the company, including the most senior executives, can be deemed to must have known. That's not a doctrine that this circuit has ever recognized, and I would point the court to the Ninth Circuit's Metzler case, Corinthian Colleges, where the allegation that simply there was some knowledge of what was going on, the day-to-day workings at the company, does not establish scienter. So I want to step back. Judge Woolley's dismissal of this investor claim should be affirmed for three independent reasons. The first is falsity, which we've addressed. I note that there are 138 statements challenged in the complaint, and it's notable that we have focused attention on one of them. And it speaks to the weakness of the vast majority of them. But number two, plaintiff fails to allege facts that give rise to a strong inference of scienter. And the Supreme Court tells us that's got to be a compelling inference on the part of any one of the four gentlemen whose names I said at the outset of my opening. And that may have been the first time that Your Honors heard some of their names today. So under the Supreme Court's precedent, plaintiff has to present facts giving rise to a strong inference that those gentlemen intentionally deceived the market or were severely reckless when they were speaking publicly. And I submit, Your Honors, that that is not found anywhere in the complaint. At bottom, this case fails because unexpected difficulties that crop up during a corporate consolidation are a business problem. They are not a securities law problem. And we learned that, or that was aptly articulated by Judge Easterbrook last month in the Zebra Technologies case, which we submitted to Your Honors under Rule 28J. So I want to turn to Sienter, which I did not hear Mr. Brown address. I do think Sienter is the simplest and clearest way to cut through the 138 statements, the vast majority of which are in any event in the PSLRA's safe harbor, undisputedly. And really, again, I want to go back to Judge Easterbrook's reasoning in Zebra, because it is exactly on fours with this case. Zebra, like this case, concerned contentions that executives had duped investors by knowingly making false statements about a post-merger integration while it was happening. And just like Mr. Lacey and Mr. Hardy and Mr. Saranik and Mr. Werther here, the Zebra executives had sold zero stock during the class period, no stock. They had enjoyed no concrete personal benefits from this supposed fraud, this vast supposed fraud. So consistent with what Judge Easterbrook said about the Sienter inquiry when you conduct it under these circumstances, Your Honors may consider two competing inferences. And these inferences can be drawn from the facts alleged and briefed and what you heard from Mr. Brown today. As plaintiffs tell the tale, Meredith's executives knew early on in the integration that it was going to be costlier than anticipated, that it was going to take longer than anticipated, and that it wasn't going to go well, and it was going to be harder than they had thought. But they chose to hoodwink investors into thinking that the integration was seamless and perfect. Now, why they would opt to do that when it would only conceal the issues for at most a few months is a mystery. That's plaintiff's inference. There is a competing inference, which is a different story. And that story is that when consolidation began, Meredith's executives had only limited information about the inner workings of Time and its assets and the difficulties in melding the businesses, which they said at the outset was going to be a project that would take years and could involve many risks and might never be successful. So difficulties, the concrete difficulties that they encountered, came to light only over time. And in this account, the early positive statements are not from a place of fraudulent intent. They are from a place of limited knowledge and optimism, corporate optimism. The integration
Can we say that, though, about Serifac? Now, maybe some of his statements aren't as specific as the fully integration statement, but Serifac was sort of leading or was on the committee leading the integration. So presumably he would know what was going on. And so to the extent he was making statements that can be viewed as puffery or whatever, is Sienter really the easiest way to go, given that he would have known what was going on?
Your Honor, the PSLRA, or the Reform Act, requires that it be pled with particularity that when a speaker made a statement, a particular statement, on a given date, that the who, what, when, where, and how of the fraud be alleged, that it be specifically alleged what they knew and how it falsified their statement. So I submit that those allegations are completely missing, as completely missing with respect to the CFO as they are with respect to anybody else. The only allegation with respect to the CFO is that he sat on a 7-member integration steering committee and that he may have seen in August and perhaps October of 2018 certain reports reflecting that certain finance department integration tasks, and as an example of one of those, finalizing a procurement policy was one of those examples. He may have seen, it's not alleged, actually, that he saw one, but he may have seen a report showing that there were some tasks like that that were still outstanding just a couple of months into the integration. That does not stand with respect, that you cannot match that up, and plaintiffs have not matched that up against any of the CFO's statements and showed that they rendered any of the CFO's statements to be false at the time that they were made. And for that reason, that those allegations as to the CFO fail as much as they do as to the other defendants who are barely mentioned. So I would note that that Zebra, I do think, is entirely on all fours, completely, and it's the same factual circumstance of a post-merger integration. But I do think that dismissal on Sienta grounds is equally harmonious with this court's ruling last year in Target. And I would note, again, Your Honor, and it bears emphasis under the Sienta inquiry, that there's zero cognizable motive that is pled for this alleged fraud. And we hear, the only motive that we hear, and you have to scrub the complaint and search to find it, is that the that these executives like their jobs and they wanted to keep their jobs and they wanted to increase the value of their stock options. That can be said about any corporate officer in America, and for that reason, this court has said in KTEL and Beverly Enterprises and others that is not a viable motive for purposes of pleading under the Reform Act. And so the question that Your Honor's answer in the Sienta inquiry is, in that vacuum that is created in the complete and utter absence of a cognizable motive, what have plaintiffs offered to fill it? And the answer is, they have their former employee allegations, and those former employees do not purport to have, even in conclusory terms, to have the ability to shed any light on the personal knowledge or the personal state of mind of any one of the individual defendants at any point in time. Not just when they made their statements. These former employees are layers upon layers upon layers removed from the executives in the organization. They're not alleged to have ever laid eyes on them. They're not alleged to have ever exchanged an email with them. And that is not, under the Sienta inquiry, anywhere near enough to get to the strong inference the plaintiffs require. The only compelling inference that can be drawn from this complaint is that these defendants failed to correctly predict the future. And the Reform Act mandates dismissal under these circumstances. And I would refer Your Honors again to Zebra and Target and many other cases for that. I do want to turn back to falsity, and I would touch on some of the statements that I think were given short shrift. So I want to make sure that I cover them, subject to any other questions that Your Honors may have on the fully integrated statement. So as I noted at the outset, 138 statements pled in plaintiff's complaint. 110 of those are forward-looking. They are plans and objectives that defendants estimated, anticipated, expected to attain in the future about integration, phases, integration costs, integration synergies. Certainly they talked about EBITDA. What Mr. Brown, I think, elided some in his account is that the EBITDA that was being discussed was for fiscal 2020, and the company articulated a goal for what they hoped to be able to achieve in fiscal 2020 in 2018. So it was not a guidance that was provided during or even close to the time in question. It was always articulated as a goal. But in any event, that is the context for that. They also talked about circulation. They talked about advertising. They talked about subscription acquisition costs and their hopes to improve those, to Mr. Brown's point about the low margin subscriptions. All of those are within the safe harbor, Your Honors. I do not believe that there's been any serious dispute that the defendant's cautionary language was precise. It was on point. Judge Woolley took note of it. It was not generic. It was specific to Meredith. It was specific to time. It called out issues like, we may have trouble integrating our operations, and we may have trouble integrating our systems. It made reference to accounting. It noted that there could be increased headcount. These are from the integration project. These are all warnings, specific warnings that the defendants gave and reiterated throughout the class period, and they protect the forward-looking statements. In the briefing, there is some, I would say, quibbling about whether some of the statements about whether the defendants were on track to achieve a synergies goal or not, were not forward-looking. I think that is definitively answered by the Ninth Circuit's ruling earlier this year in Ruokos v. Tesla, and the overwhelming weight of the case law and common sense supports the conclusion that those are forward-looking. So the only sort of handful, once we've covered the forward-looking statements and the fully integrated statement that we've discussed at some length, are a statement by Mr. Saranek that work to integrate Time Inc. is meeting our expectations. You heard Mr. Brown mention that as one of his strongest. That statement was made in November of 2018, so again, just a few months into the integration. This is a soft and a puffing statement, and all it conveys is that the integration was happening. And Judge Easterbrook and Zebra considered effectively the same statement. There the statement was integration was progressing as planned, and Judge Easterbrook found that that was not actionable, and it was not rendered false by the fact that plaintiff had found some former employees to provide accounts that the integration had problems at that point in time and that it was not on schedule. And really that's the heart of plaintiff's falsity allegations here, are that the integration had problems and that it was not on schedule. And that's exactly what Judge Easterbrook considered and rejected in Zebra. Section 10B does not require executives to provide a complete accounting of difficulties in real time as they emerge during a corporate integration. Speaking about a developing process, especially when another corporation's assets are involved, is an uncertain enterprise. And as Judge Easterbrook put it, securities law does not force corporations into this sort of no-win circumstance. The plaintiff's case here is attempting to put Meredith in a no-win circumstance. I want to briefly touch on loss causation, and then briefly touch on Judge Woolley's dismissal of this action with prejudice. So to be corrective, a disclosure has to reveal that an earlier statement was false when it was made. This court's Rand Hart v. Dolan case illustrates that quite well. And further, mere disappointing guidance, changing your guidance in a way that disappoints investors under the Retec case that we've cited, by definition, is not a corrective disclosure. Plaintiff alleges, I actually only heard mention of one of them today, but plaintiff actually alleges in the complaint that the truth came out on three different disclosure dates. The first was when the defendants moved forward their synergy timeline, although they never backed away from that estimate, and I will note that the complaint alleges that a third-party firm actually verified that they had achieved their estimate. But in any event, there is the allegation that just because they said it would take them a few more months to achieve the synergies, that was a corrective disclosure. That's foreclosed by Retec. The next disclosure is taking down, saying we are not going to meet our $1 billion EBITDA goal for fiscal 2020, but here's, now that we are much closer in the year, here's where we can guide for 2020. Again, under Retec, that is not a corrective disclosure. And the last alleged corrective disclosure is that Mr. Saranek would retire as the CFO. There is nothing, and it was not immediate. He retired in the following quarter. It was an announcement of his plans. He was close to, but not quite at, retirement age. And there's absolutely nothing well-pled allegation that there was anything nefarious behind that retirement. And under that, the cases that we've cited, the mere fact of an executive retirement, which is a fact of life, is not enough to resuscitate a failed scienter theory. Judge Woolley did properly exercise his discretion when he denied this action with prejudice. I would note the court's dismissal or affirmance of a dismissal with prejudice under precisely the same circumstances in MEMC Electronic and Novastar. The plaintiff never presented Judge Woolley with a proposed amendment. They simply dropped a one-line footnote in their resistance brief saying we'd like to amend. That's foreclosed by the Southern District of Iowa local rules, which requires a litigant to submit a proposed amendment. Plaintiffs also never made any sort of follow-up motion with Judge Woolley after he dismissed with prejudice, attempting to present a proposed amendment. Plaintiffs are effectively proceeding from the supposition that securities plaintiffs are subject to some sort of special dispensation, some sort of rule. That's not some sort of, they're not subject to the rules that ordinary litigants are with respect to pleadings. That's not the law in this circuit. I ask that this court affirm Judge Woolley's dismissal of this action with prejudice. Thank you, Your Honors.
See no questions. Thank you, Ms. Lightdale. Mr. Brown, your rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I know I have limited time, so let me make 3 points very quickly, and thank you for listening. First of all, maybe this is my small town origin speaking, but this is an adult bite case. You don't get one free lie. And I think I heard an argument that, well, maybe we lied once, but we didn't lie the other times, which they did. But that's not a get out of jail free card. And over again, all of the statements in this case, the defense argument, if you look at it at a higher level, is, well, maybe we weren't totally predicting the future. Well, they should not have spoken under the securities laws with such specificity if they did not know what they were talking about, and we allege they had contrary information. Two, I do refer, Your Honor, to the Rand Park Dolan case, because it absolutely eviscerates the idea that the cautionary language in this case, which referred to national market and economy issues, protects these statements. And I understand I'm out of time, but three, for the motive, just to respond to what my opponent said, you know, it's very interesting that we don't have to plead motive, first of all, but it's very interesting that the truth came out here in the fourth quarter of fiscal year 2019, after the auditors had audited them. And it's very interesting that the truth came out at that point, and they were forced to say it, and it's very interesting that 2 weeks later, Defendant Serenat was fired. So I would submit—
Mr. Brown, your time's expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Lightdale and Mr. Brown. We appreciate both counsel's presence before the court this morning and the argument that you've provided to us, the briefing that you've submitted. We will take the case under advisement.